Professor John Pittard from Yale Divinity School, and his paper is called Fundamental Disagreements and Defeat. And commenting will be Sam Carter from Oxford.
Okay, so first I want to say thanks to John, because I think it's a really interesting paper. What I want to do is first just give a brief summary of what I take the core argument to be, and then offer four comments or so, which maybe we can get us started in a conversation on it. So I take the primary goal of the paper is to propose a theory which can adequately capture a particular data point regarding how we're supposed to respond when we find that our epistemic peers disagree with us. So it seems like there's pretty widespread agreement that how we ought to respond in these cases is going to depend in some way on the topics of disagreement, right? And in particular, it's going to depend on whether the disagreements are what we can term superficial disagreements or fundamental disagreements. So to give an example of a case of superficial disagreement, suppose that you and I are at a restaurant and we're tossing up the bill and we're both, you know, equally good, or I mean, in this case, probably equally bad at maths, so that we come to different conclusions. Now, it looks intuitively like it would be entirely inappropriate for me, after I realize that we've come to different conclusions, to maintain the same level of confidence that my calculation was correct. And in particular, on the equal weight view, as John characterizes it, in these cases of superficial disagreements, the weight I assign to my disputant's opinion ought to be equal to the weight that I assign to my own. Conversely, fundamental disagreements are going to involve things like disagreements over religious issues, political issues, or moral issues. So, for example, if I think that exploitation is an intrinsic feature of the capitalist mode of production, then it looks like it's going to be spineless of me to significantly lower my credence just on finding out that you disagree with me. It looks like the response in these sorts of cases is going to be have to be of a completely different kind to that in the superficial cases. And it's a desideratum of an acceptable theory of how we ought to respond to disagreements that is able to capture how the response is supposed to differ in these two cases. So I think we can then view John's argument as comprising of three steps. So first, he argues that conditionalizing on evidence of disagreement is going to lead me to come to the credence which the equal weight view suggests I would have in cases of superficial disagreement, just in case my conditional credences are fixed according to what he calls instrumentalism. Secondly, that conditionalizing in the manner recommended by instrumentalism depends upon my having an antecedent prior which is independent of the cognitive faculties on which I'm conditionalizing. And that finally, from here, he's going to show that agents whose a priors fail to disagree, agents whose a priors disagree are going to fail to converge when they conditionalize on their disagreements. And this is going to be able to establish a way in which we might be able to show that our responses in cases of fundamental disagreements are going to differ from our responses in cases of superficial disagreements. So instrumentalism is described in the paper as the thesis that when we're updating our beliefs on new evidence, we should treat the deliverances of our cognitive faculties like the readouts of a complex instrument. So according to instrumentalism, the results of an agent conditionalizing on their evidence ought to match their beliefs about the reliability of the cognitive faculties which produce that evidence. So for example, suppose that I believe that my cognitive faculties produce reliable results about the horse that won a close horse race in about 90% of the time. Now, according to instrumentalism, as long as no horse is antecedently more likely to win the race, then my conditional credence that a particular horse won, given that my evidence represents that horse's winning, ought to be around 0.9. Now, for instrumentalism to be coherent, it depends on us taking a particular characterization of the evidence which is produced by my cognitive faculties. In particular, it's going to have to be the case that the evidence which my cognitive faculties produce when they function correctly is going to have to be the same as the evidence they produce when they function incorrectly. And there might be a reason to be slightly concerned about it here, because it seems to open the road to skepticism, in a wide range of cases. But one of the key ways to avoid skepticism, I take it, is to say that we get evidence which is different in kind when our cognitive faculties function reliably and when they malfunction. And if, in order to adopt an instrumentalist attitude, we have to say that evidence is the same in the good case and the bad case, we might want to be hesitant about cutting off that road to avoiding skepticism. But setting this concern aside, we can see how instrumentalism recommends we respond in cases of peer disagreement. So as long as we impose as a necessary condition on epistemic peers that they mutually believe that their cognitive faculties are going to be equally reliable, then conditionalizing on superficial disagreement is going to lead to the results recommended by the equal weight view, just in case their credences are fixed according to the way instrumentalism recommends they ought to be fixed. So suppose that you believe that my cognitive faculties are just as reliable as yours regarding the outcome of close horse races, namely that they're 90% reliable. Now, if we suppose that both of the horses involved in this race have an equal chance of winning, then your conditional credence that a particular horse won, given that I report that my cognitive faculties represented that horse as winning, ought to be 0.9. And the equal weight view recommends that in this case, which is a case of superficial disagreement, if our cognitive faculties produce conflicting evidence, then given that we're epistemic peers, you ought to give the same consideration to both of our views. It would be inappropriate for you to treat your cognitive faculties as in some way superior simply in virtue of the fact that they're your own. But this requires that your credence that a particular horse won, given that your cognitive faculties represented it as winning, is also 0.9. Which is just the credence which is required by instrumentalism. So conditionalizing on this disagreement, if our conditional credences match those which instrumentalism recommends, is going to lead you to have a posterior credence of 0.5, and the same is going to be true for me if I've conformed to instrumentalism. And the only way that we're going to get this response, as long as we want to adhere to the principle, is if agents' pre-disagreement conditional credences the credence which are recommended by instrumentalism. So that's the first stage in John's argument. Now, the start of the second section, John notes that an agent's credence in P, after updating on an item of evidence E, is going to be partially dependent on their conditional credences in E given P and E given not P, which are going to be fixed according to instrumentalism by their beliefs about the reliability of the cognitive faculties which produce evidence of the kind of E. But they're also going to be partially dependent on their priors for P. And this has two implications for the application of instrumentalist style thinking to disagreement. So firstly, the results of conditionalizing on peer disagreement isn't going to be the equal weight view if the equal weight view is taken as requiring that we split the difference between our credences. What's going to happen when we conditionalize on receiving conflicting evidence is just going to be that we return to our credences which we had prior to receiving any evidence at all. And in any case where our antecedent prior, which we're supposed to share in the case of superficial disagreement, in any case where our antecedent prior doesn't give equal probability to both P and not P, the credence which we settle on isn't going to be the midpoint between our two credences, it's just going to be our prior credence. However, John suggests, and I think you're right in this, that splitting the difference would be an implausible constraint on the equal weight view, that the equal weight view really ought to require just that we give the same weight to your cognitive faculties and mine, and that this isn't going to lead us to split the difference. Secondly, we can only take the output of a cognitive faculty as an item of evidence on which to conditionalize in the way recommended by instrumentalism if we have an antecedent credence on which to fall back, which isn't the product of the cognitive faculties on which we're conditionalizing. And for this reason, it's not going to be possible to adopt an instrumentalist attitude to all of my doxastic states at once. I'm going to have some which are left independent. And in particular, it's not going to be possible to take a thoroughly instrumentalist attitude to my priors, because in calculating in adopting an instrumentalist attitude to the cognitive faculties which produce those other priors, I'm going to have to use the other prior itself in determining what my updated credence ought to be. And this suggests a way in which we might be able to capture the data point which is of interest in the paper, because it suggests that when agents disagree regarding their priors and they conditionalize on the disagreement, they're not going to be led to converge on a common credence because they're going to have to use their separate priors in deciding what their updated credence ought to be. And so if we understand fundamental disagreements as involving disagreements over priors, instrumentalism predicts that, unlike in the superficial cases, our priors are not going to converge. Agents can't give equal weight to their own cognitive faculties and those of their epistemic peer, since they have to use the prior which is produced by their own cognitive faculties. And John concludes from this that instrumentalism offers a way in which we can adopt the equal weight view when we apply it to superficial cases, but can refrain from stating that in cases of fundamental disagreement between priors, agents' credences ought to converge. And in this way, we can reject independence and capture the data point at the heart of the paper. So what I want to do is look at four different kind of possible ways of responding to this, or four things which might be of interest. So first of all, I want to think about what precisely our intuitions are regarding how our responses ought to differ in the fundamental and the superficial cases. So while it seems that people agree that the response in these cases ought to be different, it's not precisely clear what the difference ought to be. So you might think that in superficial cases, while you ought to adopt a conciliatory response, it's not necessarily the equal weight view. And if it's not the equal weight view, then instrumentalism isn't going to give you the outcome you want. You might think there's some other sort of conciliatory requirement that falls short of giving the same sort of response to your cognitive faculties and to your epistemic peers. But I think more plausibly, we might think that in cases of fundamental disagreement, not only are we not required to adopt the equal weight view, but we're not required to be conciliatory at all. That when we disagree on moral, political, or religious issues, there's something wrong in lowering our credences in any way, given that when we find out about disagreements. And this is going to be a problem for instrumentalism, because although instrumentalism suggests that our credences ought not to converge after we find that we disagree on a fundamental issue, we ought still to be conciliatory. So in calculating how to respond to a fundamental disagreement, I'm going to have to use my prior when I'm updating. But I'm still going to be conciliatory in some response. I can still lower my credence if I find out that you have a lower credence than I do. And this leads to a further problem for John. So John claims that if religious disagreement is driven by disagreement in fundamental plausibility judgments, then on his account, peer disagreement need not constitute a defeater for religious belief. And it seems like this is going to depend partially on how we understand a defeater. So if a defeater is understood as any item of evidence which is going to lead us to lower our credence in a particular proposition, then even if all religious disagreements are disagreements in priors, we're still going to be required to be conciliatory. And in this sense, finding out about a disagreement about a religious issue is still going to count as a religious defeater. However, we might have a stronger view of a defeater, whereby a defeater has to lower your credence below some sort of particular threshold. But in this case, it doesn't seem like there's going to be like a fundamental difference between what's recommended when our priors disagree and what's recommended when we have a dispute neutral prior which we both share in a disagreement. After all, on the equal weight view, even if we have the same prior regarding a religious proposition, and conditionalizing on it could still lower our credence below the threshold, and it could still be a defeater in that case. So I think more is going to have to be said on what's supposed to constitute a defeater in this case, and how disagreement and enterprise is supposed to be immune to leading to defeat. Secondly, I take it that the intuitive distinction between cases of fundamental and superficial disagreement is drawn in terms of the topics of disagreement. So how I ought to respond to discovering that a peer disagrees with me seems to vary according to the subject on which we disagree. Yet, instrumentalism predicts that different that we'll have different responses, not according to the topic, but according to whether the disagreement is a disagreement regarding enterprise or not. And as long as there are no restrictions on how we pick our enterprise, this form of disagreement could be a disagreement, it seems, on any topic. Our enterprise could diverge no matter what the topic is. And it's not then clear how instrumentalism helps us to capture our intuitions on how our responses to cases of disagreement ought to differ. And instead, it looks like it might be producing a bit of a problem, because we seem to have pretty strong intuitions that in cases which are normally referred to as cases of superficial disagreement, we ought to be, well, our credences ought to converge. But if our enterprise can disagree on these topics, then according to instrumentalism, our credences aren't going to converge on these topics. Now, of course, you might want to say that you might want to impose some sort of restriction on how rational agents pick their enterprise. But there's both going to have to be a story here on what sorts of things constrain, in superficial cases, the cases that we normally think of as superficial topics, the enterprise we pick. But you're also going to have to tell a story about why those rational constraints aren't going to apply to topics which would be standardly seen as fundamental, topics of fundamental disagreement. Thirdly, I'm not entirely clear, and this might be just me not fully getting the position, I'm not entirely clear why non-convergence ought to be limited to disagreement in enterprise. Right, so it seems instrumentalism predicts that after conditionalizing on conflicting evidence from our cognitive faculties when we're epistemic peers, we're going to return to our antecedent credence, which we had prior to receiving that conflicting evidence and receiving the evidence that we disagreed on it. But it seems like this is going to lead us to fail to converge in any sorts of cases where our priors aren't the same prior to learning of the disagreement. It seems like it's not just going to lead to failure of convergence where we have divergent enterprise, but if we've been exposed to different evidence and therefore have different priors, yes, we'll return to the same credence after conditionalizing on the on evidence of disagreement, but as long as we don't have a dispute neutral prior before the disagreement, we're just going to return to different priors. And finally, I wonder whether this talk of convergence is a red herring. So if agents with different priors don't converge, it seems like they might still be able to respond in the way that the equal weight view recommends. After all, they're still giving equal weight both to the reliability of their own cognitive faculties and the reliability of their disputants. Even if they end up with different priors, if they conditionalize in the same way on their own evidence and that of their disputant, it seems like they've still done what's in the spirit of the equal weight view. Right, they've still, their confidence given their own cognitive faculties is still the same as their disputants. So I think that's all I've got. Leave it there.
Okay, before I respond, I want to say first thank you to Sam. Your summary, I think, was excellent. You raised some great questions. I think it would be a great place to start a conversation. I also want to thank the New Insights and Directions for Religious Epistemology Workshop for inviting me to be here. It's thrilling to be at Oxford, even if nothing else good happens to me in my life, I can at least say. I delivered a paper at Oxford that's so, I'm thrilled to be here. So I think Sam did a great job of capturing the essential points of the paper. So what I want to do is just kind of march down some of the worries he raised and address them. and then that might clarify a few things about my position as well. So he has four kind of points that came after the summary, but during the summary he did raise a worry about a skepticism threat that might come from the kind of instrumentalist view. I should say, by the way, that I am sympathetic to this instrumentalist view, although strictly speaking, what I'm doing is, in the paper, is offering it as what I take to be the most plausible basis for a conciliatory view on disagreement. So one might want to reject instrumentalism, but then I think you're going to be, you know, departing from anything that resembles conciliationism. So I'll be happy to try to defend instrumentalism, but just know that I'm offering it as what I take to be the most plausible kind of construal of a broadly conciliatory position. And it is true that instrumentalism is essentially a thesis about how to characterize my evidence, and it's a way of kind of adopting a critical distance to certain doxastic responses and inclinations I'm inclined to have, and not treating, so in the horse race case, for example, I don't take as, even if I did witness horse A win by a nose, I don't take as a piece of evidence that horse A won by a nose. If I do that, then there's just no way, at least not in any conventional Bayesian sense, to get to any kind of conciliatory result when I hear person B say that they saw horse B win by a whisker or whatever it is. So what I do is I take as my evidence something that's much more subjective. I take my evidence that it seems to me with such and such degree of confidence in such and such a state, that's normally how I feel in situations like this or something like that, that horse A won by a nose. So it's a way of constricting my evidence. The position doesn't require that we do this in all cases. I think it's impossible to do it in all cases because there's a kind of infinite regression potential. But this is an ideal. So the more we can do this, the more we're going to be having views that kind of align with our beliefs about our cognitive reliability. And Sam's point about skepticism is, well, if that's how I characterize my evidence, then my evidence will be the same whether or not horse A really won by a nose, right? And that seems problematic, because how are we going to avoid skepticism unless in the good cases there's a difference in kind in the evidence from the bad cases? I'm not going to fully address this right now, but I think the quick answer would be, as long as we have background belief in the reliability of this evidence that reliably indicates the truth, and whether or not the evidence, whether it is different in the good cases and the bad cases, the evidence can still serve to reasonably ground confidence in the proposition towards which the evidence points. And of course, if that's all the evidence you have, then it's going to be susceptible to your belief it's based on. It's going to be susceptible to being undermined by, for instance, peer disagreement, because that's evidence of a similar sort, and it's kind of at the right level. You know, my evidence is my seeming. Assuming I trust the words of my peer, then what I know is that there's a contrary seeming had by my peer. But it seems that, you know, the conciliationist is going to be perfectly comfortable with allowing our beliefs to be susceptible to that kind of undermining, to be vulnerable in that way. So let me kind of go down Sam's four main points. So he makes the good point, and actually he didn't point this out in his comments, but he did in an email to me. I said something too strong in my paper. At some point, I think I said, you know, instrumentalism doesn't underwrite conciliatory responses and fundamental disagreements. And I should have said something like this: instrumentalism explains why there are demanding conciliatory requirements and superficial requirements, but it doesn't underwrite similarly demanding conciliatory requirements and fundamental disagreements. But it does, or at least it can, underwrite more modest conciliatory requirements and fundamental disagreements, because even if I'm not going to converge with my peer on the same credence, because we start with different fundamental starting points, we start with different a priori, nonetheless, assuming I take my peer to be reliable with respect to er priors, that's going to be some evidence, just like any other piece of empirical evidence, against the thing that I believe, you know, on the basis of, say, a higher er prior. So my credence is going to shift. It's just that the shifts, when we're both instrumentalizing in the appropriate way, the shifts won't lead us to converge. So there's still conciliation, it's just not as extreme. And he says, well, maybe the intuition here, the datum that I'm trying to explain, namely the superficial requirements require a greater degree of conciliation than than fundamental disagreements. Maybe the real datum is that we're not required to be conciliatory at all, at least with these really core fundamental commitments. Then he raises the further problem that, maybe if there's some conciliation required, you might say that disagreement can still serve as a defeater. So I'm not really emptying religious disagreement of its defeating power. So I want to make two responses here. One is that to me, and you know, to boast of those who have at least some sympathies in the conciliatory camp, it's just going to seem implausible in most cases of so-called fundamental disagreement to think that there shouldn't be any conciliation at all when someone who's informed and intelligent disagrees with me. So I don't see that as a worry for me. There might be some cases where, you know, someone says 1 + 1 = 5, where it is implausible for there to be any shift, but I think that could be explained in the instrumentalist framework by a prior of one in the proposition, or at least something substantially close to one, that there's no discernible shift in my confidence. So another point I want to make, though, is it's actually, I said earlier that the instrumentalist framework will require conciliation in these disputes, assuming I take my peer to be reliable, or to have er priors that are reliable indicators of the truth. But even if I take this person to be my peer, and my peer at the er prior level in the relevant domain, it's not actually the case that I need to. It may not be the case that I think my peer is reliable, because I may not think my most antecedent view about human beings may be, well, they're not reliable. There's no reason to think they have reliable er priors, say, in the domain of religion or morality. And that would go for myself, antecedent to knowledge of what my er priors are, right? So I might have, look, before I know anything about what my er priors are, I'm a human being. I don't especially think human beings are likely to be reliable in moral matters or religious matters, so I don't think I'm a reliable agent. However, I do have a really high er prior for the wrongness of torture. I note that my er prior for the wrongness of torture is really high. That's an empirical fact. I update on that. Eventually, my beliefs and my reliability might be grounded in, I mean, it's a trivial, of course, inference that anyone's going to be able to make. Nonetheless, I have special reason, you know, for thinking that I'm reliable in this domain. That's not my most antecedent commitment is not my reliability. My most antecedent commitments are all these particular facts about morality or religion or whatever. And of course, trivially, that's going to require me to think that I'm reliable. But that's not, in a sense, my most antecedent starting point before the empirical evidence of what er priors I happen to have. And so now when I encounter a peer disagreement, someone who disagrees with me on these er priors, if my most antecedent view is not that human beings are likely to be reliable in these matters, then even though in some antecedent level this is my peer, I don't think there's a reason why I have to just assume that this person is going to have reliable er priors in the relevant domain. That being said, I mean, I think that, you know, it would be implausible to just kind of have as your antecedent starting point that, you know, we're not cognitively reliable and try to bootstrap up your beliefs in reliability just, you know, in virtue of this kind of, you know, bootstrapping maneuver. I don't think that's plausible in all domains, but that was a lot. That's probably a lot murkier than I'd like it to be, but I'm going to leave it for now and move on to the other points. But the point is, the main takeaway is, conciliation may not be required if you're not committed to thinking at the most antecedent level that, you know, you or your peers are reliable. It may not be required even in so-called pure disagreement at the fundamental level. That being said, I think it often will be required. The second point is Sam suggests that, at least the way it's typically discussed, the fundamental superficial distinction tracks topics or domains. And if I'm characterizing fundamental disagreement as disagreement at the level of erpriors, there's no reason to think that that will, that the fundamental superficial distinction will track certain domains, that certain domains' disagreements will tend to be fundamental, other domains will tend to be superficial. Because after all, any topic could be subject to differences in the priors. So at one level, I want to say, well, maybe if that's how the, maybe I just am taking, you know, I'm using a different notion of fundamental, if it truly is, you know, that when people try to back off conciliatory requirements and fundamental disagreements, if they do mean that it doesn't apply to these domains, I might just disagree. You know, I might think there's no inherent reason why one domain should have a different kind of different account of the epistemic significance than other domains. That being said, even though I think you could find fundamental disagreement in any sort of domain, I don't think there's going to be firm domain restrictions here. I do think that it's much more likely to encounter fundamental disagreements in certain domains and superficial disagreements in other domains. So take, for example, you know, Christensen's by now well-known restaurant case that Sam kind of alluded to, dispute over bill tabulation. And let's look at the cases originally stated where I arrive at the number 43. My friend arrives at the number 45. It's very different than the case where my friend arrives at the number 450. You know, antecedent to the calculation, I think there's going to be some realm of plausibility, and it's unlikely that 43 will receive a higher prior credence, antecedent credence from me than 45, or at least not significantly higher, because it's opaque, you know, where I'm going to end up after this calculation. I know I'm going to be maybe in the neighborhood of 30 to 50 or something like that. But I think in a lot of these superficial disagreements, something like an indifference principle is going to be appropriately applied in the domain. There's going to be some kind of a clear way to carve up the space and relatively clean ways of kind of distributing your antecedent credence. So, I mean, the horse race case is another good example. Unless we have special information about the horses, it just doesn't seem reasonable to start off with some skewed distribution that favors horse A winning over horse B. I mean, again, that's a different case than if we've seen the horses and one is a scrawny little baby horse, you know, and one is a massive racing horse. Of course, one could have, you know, I just have my priors that brown horses are more likely to win than black horses. It's not based on any evidence, and that would be a fundamental disagreement. I just think that reasonability is often going to rule out fundamental disagreements. Certain reasonability constraints on priors are often going to rule out fundamental disagreements on, you know, superficial matters. Another worry or another wrinkle here that Sam didn't get into is some murky stuff I raised kind of at the end of the paper, saying, well, there might be a sense in which there's some erpriors that aren't truly fundamental because they're just kind of brute inclinations that we have and we go with them because we don't have anything else to go on. And in a sense, those might be grounded not on insight into any kind of intrinsic plausibility of the hypothesis. They might just be that we go on them because we have that inclination and, you know, that's the best thing we have to go on. We take ourselves to be cognitively reliable. So they're grounded in some sense, not in a Bayesian way, but they're grounded on some empirical evidence, namely the evidence that we're inclined to have them. Behind that, we don't have any, you know, actual prior. It's just a kind of ignorance behind that. And if that's the kind of erprior I have, again, in a superficial disagreement, so I might, if that's the kind of or prior dispute we have, that might qualify as superficial. I just kind of want to flag that possibility. I'm not sure that that kind of superficial is more likely to arise in certain domains than others. It might, you know, religious disagreement might be driven by our priors that are, in some sense, non-fundamental because they're brute in that sense. Even when there is an er prior dispute, there might be some way of kind of rationalizing, some way of getting behind that er prior and treating it as not a fundamental starting point. Quickly on his third point, why should non-convergence be limited to er prior differences rather than just antecedent priors? I mean, I think the basic picture here, and I don't have some kind of formal proof, although I might be able to call on others in the room who can do that for me, is if we disagree on the latest piece of evidence, but you know, we also started from a different antecedent credence, there's actually two disagreements. There's disagreements on how this latest piece of evidence should be processed, and there's also a disagreement at the level of our antecedent priors. And if those antecedent priors aren't our fundamental or priors, then there's a sense in which I can treat those instrumentally just like I treated my latest response to the evidence instrumentally. Imagine, this is a simpler case, but imagine we've responded to the same sequence of evidence. I now learn that we've, you know, processed the latest piece of evidence differently, but we also started from different antecedent credences. Well, I should just kind of backtrack and say, well, first, let's start with the antecedent credences. You know, how did we get there? And once I find the difference, you know, we're good. At some point, if it's not a fundamental disagreement, there's going to be some point at which, at some antecedent level, we'll converge, and from there, presumably, we can do some kind of instrumentalism going forward, and we'll remain converged, and we can do that at each step, and we'll end up at convergence, unless. Even when we went all the way back to the fundamental level, there was still divergence or still difference. I'm wondering is if Robert Allman's agreement theorem could help me here, although he has certain assumptions about communication that maybe I don't want to rely on. If you're familiar with that theorem, maybe you can tell me whether that will help me out. But I think really what I need here is a strong sense of epistemic peerage or peerhood, because if I truly think that, you know, the quality of evidence I've gotten is no more, I have no reason to think it's better or worse than the quality of evidence my disputant has, then I think taking an instrumentalist attitude towards my antecedent credences will lead me to convergence. Is convergence a red herring? I'm trying to remember your point there.
I mean, I think you're responding mm-hmm. to that point, you might kind of dispel that worry, because I mean, it's only going to be that convergence mm-hmm. wouldn't right. be required to adopt the equal weight view if agents could have different priors and, after conditionalizing on their disagreement, return back to the same priors while having treated each other
as absolute. That's right. So I think that. You know, convergence isn't, the equal weight view wouldn't require convergence if you're focused just on the latest aspect of the disagreement, which is the handling of this particular piece of evidence. But if you think that the person is your peer, not just with respect to this equal piece of evidence, but, you know, with respect to the whole history of updating on evidence, so you think that their history of evidential attainment is likely to be as strong and not likely to be weaker than yours. Then, you know, once you take all the disagreements into account, then on this kind of idealized instrumentalist picture, you'll converge unless there's a disagreement at the er prior level. And it should just also be noted that, you know, I can't use the notion of saying epistemic peer as having the same evidence if I'm saying the evidence should be characterized as your doxastic responses to things that you've witnessed. So two people who, even if they could be in the same vantage point and witness the same horse race, you know, they haven't had the same evidence because they have different seemings and different responses. But once they've shared those responses, there's a sense in which they do have the same evidence, and kind of the standard Bayesian picture will be, once that evidence is shared, if you started from common priors, you're gonna end up at the same place, so.
Can you get any sort of account of disagreement between peers who have the same evidence? So, like, it might be the case that epistemic peers need not share the same evidence, and the epistemic peers, in the way you're characterizing disagreement, don't. But would it be possible to have a disagreement between people with the same evidence on this model? Because it seems like that should.
Well, in a way, no, because my evidence is going to be that I had this, you know, kind of reaction to the evidence and response, or I arrived, and, you know, your evidence will be but that will refer to something else. but that's a trivial difference, you might say. It's a difference that has no bearing on the evidential weight. So beyond the triviality of that distinction, I think the only way you'd get disagreement with the same evidence is if it's fundamental. And this is also a way of bringing things like calculation into a Bayesian picture, right? I mean, if you do a math problem, I mean, there's no way to treat that in a Bayesian fashion if using the reasoning of the calculation, right? You're just gonna arrive at the answer. But if you say, no, well, at the end of the calculation, my evidence is that, you know, with such degree of confidence, I arrived at this answer, and my track record in this kind of problem has been like this, then you can kind of bring stuff like math problems and other things that normally can't be treated in a Bayesian fashion, you can kind of bring it into the Bayesian framework. But that then allows you to give a nice explanation of how you can also be required to conciliate in these kinds of disagreements. So.
Okay, well, keep your hand up until I make contact, and we'll do one finger for follow-ups. Tim?
John, I just wonder if you could address, seems to me, a kind of overlooked thing in a lot of in the disagreement literature, but it seems pretty obvious to me that, at least when it comes to philosophy, we sort of, right at the beginning, right, we learn that there's pervasive disagreement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe our instructor apologizes about it in the very first class, you know, it kind of addresses the scandal of philosophy. So it seems to me that we go on, nevertheless, we study and we form opinions, but it seems like awareness of pervasive, entrenched disagreement among smart, relevantly informed people, this awareness is, and it is kind of factored in, it's baked into the cake of our judgments. And so, why doesn't anybody say anything about that?
Someone has, although I haven't read this piece. I just saw, who's the woman from MIT that did her dissertation? I've read an abstract of a dissertation that says religious disagreement and disagreements like this are precisely immune because, you know, presumably we've already accounted for that. And so our credences should already kind of be lower precisely because of disagreement. So
yeah, I'm not necessarily pushing any specific claim, but I think it's
I mean, but I think so I don't know why people haven't talked about it, but I think that put this in an instrumentalist framework, and suppose that you think that, you know, you learn this, and this wouldn't quite be a fundamental judgment. There's not reliability because it's based on what your instructor said. But suppose you say, look, I haven't done any philosophy yet. I have no reason to think I'm more reliable than other people. And I have no reason to think other people are reliable either. So, you know, I just don't actually trust the opinions of others, not because I think I'm better, but just because I think we're not reliable on these kinds of questions. Nonetheless, you start doing philosophy, and you have certain insights that are going to ground your priors. Those error priors aren't going to be grounded on some antecedent commitment to your reliability. Of course, you know that if you do form these error priors that are, you know, not just kind of agnostic error priors, but you form kind of firm opinions on the matter, that a trivial inference is going to require you to also think you're reliable, right? I think these are the rational er priors. I happen to have those er priors. I'm reliable. So you know you're going to end up there. You haven't gained reason to trust philosophers generally, even though you're antecedent to engaging in the philosophical task. You're a peer with these people, but at the end, even though antecedently they're your peers, that just means that antecedently you have no reason to trust them, because you have no reason to trust yourself antecedently either. So I think in that case, disagreement might not dislodge you from your positions.
Yeah. I mean, on this, of course, there are plenty of scientists nowadays who would, for this reason, dismiss all of philosophy and say philosophy is at an end,
yeah.
or metaphysics is hopeless. We must stick to science. The reason being, there is, they suggest, an agreed scientific method. Now, in a lot of what you say about, say, watching horse races and so on, and what you call instrumentalism, there does seem to be an agreed method there. I mean, for instance, if somebody claims they saw which horse ran and we found they were in the bar and weren't even looking, well, we know that we can discount that. We know what counts as a proper method to contribute to this. Whereas when you get to fundamental disagreements, it is undoubtedly true that it's very difficult to say what is the method for disagreeing.
Yeah.
So the fact that there is no basic agreement, not about the things themselves, but about how you would go about settling it at one issue, but you do know how to settle it at another, even if you can't, that does seem to be quite a difference.
Yeah, I mean, those who want to dismiss philosophy, I guess the question to ask is, do they have any views on philosophical questions?
Oh, well, I think they're self-contradictory. I mean, they tend to give philosophical reasons for dismissing philosophy.
Philosophy, they mean philosophical experts. Qua philosophical experts have no, you know, there's no reason to trust them. Maybe it's not self-contradictory, right?
No, but they say there's no agreement, so there's no way of achieving.
Oh, okay, well, yeah. Well, then that. Well, there may be no way of achieving agreement, but is there a way of getting at the truth philosophically?
Well, they would say no, because philosophers have disagreed through the centuries and they're no better off now.
Then they would be self-contradictory if they had philosophical views, right?
Yeah.
Right. Not self-contradictory may be a little strong, but
And then went on to talk about why we have to assume there is a reality to investigate. So he was immediately contradicting himself.
Yeah.
Okay, Maria.
Thanks so much. So I just wanted to get clear on how this framework works. And I guess I have this worry that when you're applying the thermometer model to yourself, or the instrumentalist way of thinking to yourself and to your peer, you're actually applying it to different things.
Mm-hmm.
So in your view, there are the deliverances, which at least ideally you're thinking about is the evidence. And the deliverances are something like, it seems to me thus and so with such and such clarity, or I'm inclined to judge that P, I'm inclined to assign a credence of R to P, right? And then that's your sort of evidential input, then you do conditionalization, and then you arrive at your doxastic state. So there's the deliverance and there's the doxastic state. And the instrumentalist way of thinking sort of replies the kind of measuring device model to the deliverance, right? But typically, at least like in the disagreement literature, when you encounter a peer, what you learn is their doxastic state, right?
Right.
So you get the kind of the output. So, but it seems that you're sort of now applying this metrics model to that doxastic state. And it seems that in a simple horse race case, maybe it doesn't matter because it's like, I'm inclined to judge that horse A1, and then I believe that horse A1, and then I learn that my peer believes that horse B1, and I can sort of work my way backwards to, you know, their sort of deliverance. But once you go into a creedal context, I mean, it's sort of unclear to me how this works. So my deliverance is something like, I'm inclined to assign credence of 0.4 to P, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I do some conditionalization. I'd like to hear more about how it works, but I might arrive at a credence that's different from I might say, well,
sure,
you know, on past occasions when I go for 0.4, you know, the probability of the relevant proposition is, or it's been false in 20% of cases, and I.
This is like Sherilyn Rausch's kind of calibrate, and I'm using her terminology, but the calibration is the idea that she calls them credences. I would say something like an inclination towards a credence or something,
right.
But might be evidence for something. I mean that justifies a credence other than the initial credence that you have, right? Because maybe you have a tendency to be overconfident or under.
Right. I mean, I take it this is not the original credence. It's my inclination to assign a credence, which is deliverance. But I sort of, so I arrive at my sort of final doxastic state by sort of conditionalizing. case into the end point of Sussex 8?
Yes, so they are different sorts of evidence, right? I mean, one, I have a sort of access to the doxastic, sorry, to the deliverance, as you're calling it, that I don't have in the case of my disputant, right? And there might be times where there's something like this distinction can make a difference. If I think that disagreements are likely to happen when there's some fuzziness that would be apparent, you know, going on, or some, this is kind of Lackey's appeal to private information. I think this can sometimes make a difference, that you might think all I have is the output, so to speak, or the claimed output or whatever from my disputant, but I don't have access to kind of the internal, a fine-grained access to internal deliverances like I do to myself. And maybe I think my deliverances are much more reliable evidential indicator in this case than the claimed doxastic state of my disputant. But in some situations, there might be a slight difference. I mean, just throw in, for example, I mean, you can throw in possibilities of deception, possibilities of just misreporting. I mean, those possibilities might be there for your disputant and not in your own case. So even if I take my disputant in the horse race case to be equally reliable, if they have similar deliverances, since I don't know they have similar deliverances, I might discount their reliability slightly. But suppose I think their reporting is a really reliable indicator of the kind of deliverances they had, and I suspect that in most cases when they say things like, it seemed clear to me that horse B won, it was close, but it seemed still clear to me, I might think that's a really reliable indicator of similar deliverances going on in their head that went on in my head. And so because it's one step removed, there's going to be some discounting. So, you know, maybe the deliverances are 0.9 reliable and either of us, I arrive at 0.9 antecedent to the disagreement. Maybe I take the claimed doxastic state to only be a 0.89 indicator or something. So it's, I think often, at least in these cases, superficial disagreement, because we think generally when there's disagreement, there's not clear markers, there's not something that if I was just inside the other person's head, it would be obvious that things were fishy and going on wrong. We don't think deception is likely. You know, I think that extra step isn't going to have much of an impact.
But I mean, in the case of a CRIDA, say you assign that your peer assigns a CRIDA of 0.2 to P.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might be really hard to reverse engineer yourself into their actual deliverance. They have all kinds of really messy evidence and priors.
Yeah, so, I mean, the horse race case is a clean case, right? Because we assume stuff like initially we have common antecedent credences on who's more likely to win. We're sitting in very similar vantage points. In murky cases, I think stuff like private information, knowledge about the path that I went, you know, the path that I've taken to get to my current credences can have magnified differences. Because at that point, the evidential value, the reliability I assign to the evidential weight I assigned to the report of my disputant might be significantly less. I think conversation can often restore or, you know, some understanding of how my disputant got to where he or she is, and if there's some degree of parity and similarity, then the instrumentalist story will start to have its effects. So, I mean, I was imagining, you know, suppose there's a religious disagreement, and my religious belief is somewhat based on a history of committed prayer and seeing that have effects in the life of me and my friends. And then I meet someone who just tells me, well, I've prayed a lot and have had no, you know, it's just good evidence that God doesn't exist. There's no kind of response to that prayer. I mean, initially, if that's all I know, clearly I know a lot more information about me than this friend who's reported this. Of course, if I start to talk with that person and find that they've had a similarly committed history of praying and stuff, then, you know, their evidence starts to look more on a par with mine. And I think at that point, the instrumentalist story will come closer to approximating the truth, so to speak, and how I should respond to that.
Okay, Mike. So you mentioned that this distinction between brute and rational herb priors, and I think there might be something valuable to bring up that distinction, although you say some will question whether it's tenable or at least useful for this purpose. So I guess I do question that.
Mm-hmm.
So think about, and that, so I'll just explain why I think this is a strong similarity between the two, and you can push back a bit more and defend this distinction. I know you're not committed to it, but I'd like to see if you want to defend it against my concerns. So on one hand, we have perceptual and memory scenes.
Yes.
Very strong ones, right? It seems very strongly to me perceptually that there are people in the room.
Yeah.
It seems very strongly to me that you're presenting your response recently. Memory scenes. So I had these very, very strong scenes. These aren't insights into the way things have to be. They're insight. They're scenes about the way things contingently were or are. And then there's, on the other hand, we might have logical mathematical scenes, maybe simple ones, or at least ones that are sort of equally strong, although in this case it's scenes about the way things have to be.
Yeah.
So there is that different. In the latter case, you might think it's a kind of insight case. I think this is the way things have to be. But in each case, there are these scenes, and you call them inclinations, but I'll just call them scenes about the way things are. So I say that there's a difference. In one case, it's rational insight. In the other case, it's not. And then we have these higher level scenes, where we think, well, the perceptual and memory ones, that they're reliable scenes. And the same with in the other case, you know, we think that the logical mathematical scenes are, they seem to us to be reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Those are both, neither of those higher level scenes are insights into the way things have to be, because
right.
they don't have to be reliable with my prior logical ones.
Yeah.
Now I could bring in the lower level ones in the logical mathematical case to sort of make a case for the other ones, you know, being reliable,
right.
but that can do that in the memory case as well, bring in the lower level ones to make the case. So it seems to me that there's a parity at the lower level in terms of strength of seeming, even though there's a difference in the one's insight and one's not. And then at the higher level, there's a parity in, like, a very strong parity in that they're both maybe strong seemings about the verticality of the first level seemings.
Yeah.
And they're maybe equally strong. If you make the perceptual memory beliefs in question, ones that I'm extremely confident in, and you make the mathematical, logical ones complicated enough so that they're just as strong, then there's all this parity, and I'm kind of thinking, why give the nod to the one and say that those are they can't be treated instrumentally, the rational insight ones can't be treated instrumentally, whereas the brute ones can. So I'm just wondering how you can defend that.
I mean, I know that a lot of people aren't going to like, you know, how I am inclined to say that there's a very big difference in these cases, and I think actually disagreement can help bring that out. I think there's a sense in which I can see the truth of 1 + 1 = 2, in which I can't see the truth of there's a sense. Of course, there's a sense in which I can see that Sam is sitting there. But I think there's another sense in which I can't do that, at least in this, with the same directness, because it's mediated by an output of my sensory faculties. That's the means by which I know Sam is sitting there. That is something that can be duplicated even if he's not sitting there.
But so can the very strong seeming.
That 1 + 1 = there could be a strong seeming that 1 + 1 = 3 that's just a strong inclination to believe that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the character of the insight that I have to 1 + 1 = 2 can be duplicated in support of someone, you know, in the mind of someone who believes that 1 + 1 = 3.
Take all the kinds of confidence. It seems to you that you've got a rational insight into 1 + 1 = 2. That's sort of a seeming about the seeming. Couldn't an evil demon make you feel that same way? Make not maybe, you know, somebody feel that same way about 1 + 1 = 3? Of course, maybe it wouldn't be into a truth, and it wouldn't be, it wouldn't sort of exactly map onto the other, but it would sure seem to you like it did.
Yeah, and so this is, I think there's a distinction between the feeling and the insight here. And I think that the demon obviously can't make someone see that 1 + 1 = 3, right?
Yeah.
I think I do see that 1 + 1 = 2. So there can't be that parity. Of course, I also have a lot of confidence. And I guess the question is there a sense in which, look, everything's really just grounded in the confidence? And if that's true, I mean, if ultimately this distinction isn't tenable, then I just kind of fall back, okay, well then, you know, all our priors, kind of all fundamental starting points are kind of exempt from this kind of defeat, because that's much more plausible than saying they're all subject to defeat, I think. But I just think, and I think disagreement brings this out. So suppose that I say I see Sam sitting here and you say he's sitting here, you know, and no one else is in the room. Of course, I'm not going to believe you because I think that probably if there's a hallucination, some really fishy, well, one, you might be deceiving me. I mean, something really crazy is going on, right? So I have to, once I know something crazy is going on, now the credence, small though it may be, that I assign to Mike Bergman deceiving me is going to be relevant. The credence that, you know, things are really fuzzy in your head and things that aren't going on in my head that I can tell aren't going in my head that are going in yours is relevant. But conditional on everything being normal and you're not deceiving me, I think I have no reason to stand by my judgment that Sam is here. So in other words, if I know that your visual perception is as detailed, vivid, etc., and that you have no past history that you're not telling me about of hallucinations, let's just say we know as a background assumption that very, very rarely people suffer from strong, whether so-called strong hallucinations that are completely on par with normal seemings. And this is exactly the sort of thing that people strongly hallucinate about, where someone is in the room or something. And there's, it happens randomly, there's no bad history or anything, then I think I would at that point conciliate fully if I think that's what's going on or conditional on a strong hallucination going on. Let's say that sometimes people go the other way. They just strongly believe that 1 + 1 = 5, and it just happens. Or they strongly believe, let's just say, you know, stupid things about really basic arithmetic. I could be wrong, but I certainly feel a lot less pressure to conciliate in the case where you say, you know, I strongly feel that 1 + 1 = 5, and we both agree that there must be one of these strong mathematical hallucinations. And what I would appeal to here is the directness of the insight. Of course, there wouldn't be a strong, I guess my account suggests it can't be a strong hallucination in the same way that the perceptual case can be, because the character of the insight can't be duplicated in the person.
How about that 6 squared? A bit more complicated.
Well, once you get to something like that, I start to back off a little bit, because I don't think I have kind of a clean direct insight into 6 squared. I really don't. I mean, I guess I'm with Kant, right? What was it, like 5 + 7? You know, at that point you thought, you know, this is synthetic and, you know, you're just beyond. Yeah, I think once you go 6 squared, it's starting to get more like it's relying on memories of stuff I learned in school. And of course, I could sit down and add 6 sixes together, but by the time I get to the end, I'm not going to have before me every step in the calculation. So I'm more inclined at that point to go with the conciliatory verdict. Yeah.
Are you assuming that the priors conform to the axioms of the probability calculus, or not? I'm just
trying. So I guess. No, because if you're going to use this at all for things like calculation cases, right? Then there's going to be incoherence in me thinking that the answer to this calculation is as likely to be 43 as it is 45.
Let's just do it on tautologies. So go for logic because you can do.
Well, the same thing applies. I mean, I'm going to
right,
do a logic.
Right, so I just don't understand. I mean, you're talking about conditionalization.
Yeah.
If my priors don't are probabilistically incoherent by the axioms of the probability calculus, it's not so smooth too.
So this is a big worry, right? Because there's problems in extending a conditionalization framework when you're already violating the axioms of probability that underwrite, you know, Bayes' theorem and stuff like that. I mean, my argument why it's appropriate is to go to cases where it just clearly seems, I mean, of course, none of us satisfy those axioms anyway, right? None of us are probabilistically coherent because we don't have...
I mean, the normal representation theorems for even assigning numbers in the first place presuppose that you're probabilistically coherent. So I don't even understand the notion of assigning numbers to my priors if those representation theorems will break.
Well, but, I mean, we do have credences, and we feel that.
Well, we have better qualitative betting sort of things,
yeah.
And you know, some sorts of pairwise comparisons. But if you're going to start to use that as a basis for assigning numbers, then that will go. There'll be some representation theorems in the background,
yeah.
And if there's incoherences there, then I don't think we're in a position to think that it makes much sense to say we've got credences of the sort that could be represented by the real number scale.
Yeah, it may be that, I mean, it may be that there's not going to be a precise representation. Let me just give my kind of argument for the appropriateness of this framework. So, I mean, you go to certain types of disagreements. There's a bunch of marbles in a jar. I count them as fast as I can because I'm under time pressure. You do the same. We know our reliability rates. We get some different answers. It seems so clear to me that in this case, conditionalization is going to provide the right framework. Even given the limitations of the fact that we're not probabilistically coherent, maybe we don't have precise credences, but that's going to be the best way of modeling how we ought to respond.
But you try and do it in a situation where you're disagreeing with a paraconsistent logician. And then when you're trying to give credences to hypotheses like we're both right, which is, that's gonna, I mean, it's just not going to be so clear you can get a smooth treatment of this.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is gonna surpass my pay grade soon, but, and there may be certain types of disagreements just due to the nature of the disagreement, the content of the disputed proposition where really it really does clearly undermine the applicability of the conditionalization framework. But my essential argument is, like, let's start with a case that doesn't involve any logic, it involves counting. Let's see if we can agree on conditionalization as, even if it's not precise or something, is giving a kind of right story here. And then, is there any relevant disanalogy in the marble counting case and in the bill calculation case that says that, oh, now because math is involved, or do the logic, the long logic proof, whatever, you know, the story is going to be completely different. It might be, but that seems implausible to me. I think there's prima facie strong reason to think that the basic framework for showing how the disagreement, the significance of the disagreement ought to be the same in the two cases.
Laura? Right, thank you. This might be partly clarificatory, but I'm wondering what impact that learning that a question is one where reasonable people can persist in disagreement because of differences in error priors, what impact that should have on my credence or the way I hold that credence. So kind of, stepping back from Tim's point that we all kind of know that philosophy and religion are fraught with disagreement, when I learned that, this is a question where, unlike a bunch of other questions, reasonable people are gonna have different error priors, I mean, you might think, well, I just stick to my error prior and that's all there is, but learning that this is a question where reasonable people
right.
disagree, does that have an additional kind of impact on the way I hold it, or do I treat it
yeah.
differently now than cases where it's clear?
Well, I'm inclined to say that I think this depends on whether you think those error priors are grounded in insight or not, and so I know that this is, if you think that, like, look, this is an area where we have these inclinations to different error priors, and generally there's a lot of these kinds of error priors we have in different domains, and we have general reason to trust that we're cognitively reliable. So the fact that I have an inclination is, in a sense, grounding my trust in that error prior. And if you have no reason to trust yourself other than the fact that you're a human being and you think human beings are reliable, and then you learn that human beings aren't reliable on this topic, then I think that arguably could serve as a defeater. There's a sense, though, in which your error prior isn't truly fundamental in the sense that it's kind of grounded on a piece of empirical evidence, namely that you're inclined to have it, this is a murky, because it's not grounded on an empirical piece of evidence in a Bayesian way. It's not like you conditionalize on that evidence because there's no background, you know, antecedent credence there. But if you think your ER priors are based on your appreciating the intrinsic plausibility of the hypotheses, of the propositions, and it's based on some kind of rational insight, then arguably it's not really your commitment to that prior isn't presupposing some view on your reliability or the reliability, certainly not, it's not presupposing a view on the reliability of humankind as a whole or anything like that. So at that point, I think there would be reason to stand by your priors. So,
I mean, is this just sort of a denial that somebody else's ER priors could be sort of just as good or also as reasonable or something? I mean, is this I can stick with my ER prior and use it as long as it's the right one?
Well, if you already have reason to think that, you know, there's not general reliability, then, I mean, I don't think just someone reporting their ER prior gives you reason for thinking that it's reliable. I mean, they might be able to call your attention to some consideration, rational consideration that you haven't considered before. And if it moves you, then you ought to back off, presumably, the ER prior that you had. But given that there is a kind of general unreliability, I don't know why there'd need to be an assumption that, you know, all these ER priors are kind of grounded in, or just as good, or grounded in insights in the way that you take yours to be.
Emil?
Yeah, so my question was attending to Sam's worry about not having a difference in evidence in the good and the bad case, so the skeptical worry. And your response seemed to be that, so you're in this paper just looking at this kind of conciliatory view and this kind of a worry that, you know, if you go for a difference between the good and the bad case, then you get that in the good case you might get like end up having as your evidence that horse A won the race, and so you have probability one on that, and then when you get the other input, then you can't really, you don't get anything out of conditionalization because you still have probability one on that. So that's like, so if you go for that kind of good bad case distinction, then it looks like you just can't go anywhere with this kind of conciliatory thought.
Not without rejecting conditionalization as the appropriate way to handle the disagreement.
Yeah, so but that's what I'm thinking then, because your model, that looks right, but then it looks like the kind of story that you're going for later in the paper is not really one where the updating always goes by conditionalization, because you allow that you can sort of backtrack and then go back to like antecedent things, but then it looks like you can actually have like a good bad case distinction and still have something conciliatory going on.
Yeah, so this is a weakness in the paper that I've kind of realized very recently, that you know, initially I kind of say, look, we have to cohere with conditionalization. Although I think at least one point I say in these simple cases or superficial cases. And I think there is a distinction because in the horse race case, I already have a credence for the evidence of the disagreement of, say, you know, because I know the person is 0.9 reliable and there's a precise credence I give to the disagreement, the possibility of disagreement in virtue of knowing their track record and the likelihood that they're going to disagree. So if I'm not going to treat that piece of evidence via using conditionalization, then there's going to be, I'm going to violate epistemic reflection requirements in an implausible way. It won't be a plausible violation of epistemic reflection, because I'll say, look, I have a credence of one. I know there's a 10% chance that, you know, my peer is going to disagree, and then I'll move to a credence of 0.5. Nonetheless, I still have a credence of one. I mean, that seems implausible. There are other cases, though, where, say, I just have an inclination to a certain prior that's a result of a certain way of carving up the probability space. But there's an infinite number of ways of carving up the probability space. Which propositions do you start with in order to kind of start with the position of indifference with respect to that proposition or with respect to some other proposition. And I may just have no, because there's some infinite number of ways of doing that, I may have no, and I'm just inclined to do it this way, so I do it that way. Before I learn how Sam does it, I may have no probabilities. There may be no kind of way for me to say, here's the probability that Sam will cover it up this way, here's the probability that he'll cover it up this way. If I have those probability judgments, then it seems like that would be conditionalizing. But if I just have ignorance, if I have no reason for thinking that he's more likely to cover it up some way other than some other way, then arguably you're not going to get the same kind of worries, because I don't have any commitments about how likely the evidence is that I then receive when I learn what his position is. I think it's that sort of fundamental disagreement case is different than the superficial case where I have clear antecedent credences for the piece of evidence that I then get in the disagreement.
The little thing that struck me is when it's sort of pay lip service to instrumentalism, when you describe these horse races, you say pretty much exactly what you'd say if you thought that your evidence or the propositions you know. So in the descriptions, you use the verb know various times. And every time you do it, basically what then goes on is the state space is getting constrained by the proposition, as in, you know, suppose that Beth is with me at the horse race and that I know that she's exactly as accurate as I'm judging her. You don't say, suppose I have this judgment that she's as accurate, and then you condition, you apply your own priors to that judgment.
Yeah.
You're supposing that she reports the other horse one, and of course, it looks like you're conditionalizing on that she reported this, not that there was a seeming to you that she reported this. And so, I mean, what you actually do is say exactly what you'd say.
Yeah.
I know you're thinking, well, this is all shorthand, but it is quite striking.
Well, I'm not actually saying it's shorthand because I characterize instrumentalism as an ideal, and it's one that of course, there's limitations of instrumentalizing at the level of our priors, I've argued, but it's also even at other levels. You know, we're not going to be able to be perfect instrumentalizers all over the place. For one thing, there's just going to be an infinite regression. You know, well, it seems to me. Well, does it really seem to you? Well, it seems to me. It seems to me. You know, there's just no way to instrumentalize perfectly. So I think that what I probably need to go for here is some kind of contextualist thesis that says, you know, what the appropriate way to characterize your evidence is, where it's appropriate to instrumentalize, where it's appropriate to just take the inclinations as given and assign it credence one, take that to be your evidence, is going to somewhat depend on what's under threat, you know. And it might be that it would be ideal to kind of instrumentalize a lot further, a lot wider, and a lot further up the chain. Doesn't seem to me that it's possible for us to do that ad infinitum.
Would help me to get a bit of a feel. I mean, obviously, omniscience is an ideal in some sense.
Yeah.
And obviously, if we have seemings but we don't know what they are, it would be a bit funny to conditionalize on them. So I'm just trying to understand why you think it's an ideal to conditionalize on the things we know about our seemings, but not to conditionalize on the other things we know. I mean, it's completely mysterious.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it is an ideal to conditionalize on those other things. I just think that...
If we know,
what's that?
If we know, I mean...
I think ideally...
You're telling
me
that in the ideal, I conditionalize only on the things I know about my seemings and not the other things I know.
Well, I'm just saying, this is what I'm saying. Here would be a little bit better if you wanted to be a little bit more precise. Rather than taking as evidence that Beth reported this, take as evidence that Beth seemed to, it seems to you that Beth reported that.
Even
and calibrate.
If I didn't know that she seemed to report it, should I take that as evidence?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not,
it just
I know
seems
I use
to me
those
when
words,
I don't know the thing,
yeah.
I shouldn't take it as evidence, and when I do know the thing, I should.
If I'm gonna say knows is credence one, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is whether you're going to assign it credence one depends somewhat on just how precise and how far you want to go with this framework. And of course, there's just going to be practical limitations in that. I think if you're pushing it far, you're not going to really be assigning credence. I mean, the further you push it, the less things you're going to assign credence one to, and the kind of more higher level you're gonna have to stop at some point. You know, take something as evidence, assign it credence one. But I mean, this is a real problem, right? Because it seems like, look, if you really push to the ideal, you would just spread out, and you'd never have any stopping points with credence one, and the ideal would just be kind of. But then, where does your evidence go, right? And that's a deep problem, and I don't really know how to solve it. Nonetheless, it seems to me that, practically speaking, we take things as a given. We treat them with credence one. I mean, if we're modeling what we're doing, what's the best way to treat it? And then that comes under threat. And then we step back. We say, okay, well, you know, since that's now up for question, let me back off a little bit and move to some more subjective version of the evidence or something like that. And no longer treat with credence one when I was treating with credence one before. But I fully admit there's some deep problems about whether this can make any sense, given that there's no firm stopping point to this procedure.
All right, we have 1 minute, so Billy, if you can.
I was just wondering real quick, so you see the thing is kind of important, the idea that some of these ER priors could be based on insight with your phraseology.
It might be important, yeah.
And, I mean, it's just kind of, this is a very flat-footed thing, you might think. Well, look, if they're based on insights, that means you've got some prior views you're taking into account instead of those priors. And so they can't really be ER priors because they're taking into account some prior information.
Well, but I don't think you're taking that information into account in a Bayesian fashion, right? Like, I don't think that rational insight and philosophical insight can be given a Bayesian construal. So the kind of insights that, yeah, inform that ER prior are going to inform it and ground it some way, but not in a Bayesian fashion. So that you're not going to look for some other credence that you can then treat as the fundamental starting point of the Bayesian framework, yeah, or the Bayesian updating, history of Bayesian updating.
All right, well, please join me in thanking